I'm Jared Rayberg, and I grew up in Northborough, Massachusetts. The town was a very fast-growing town that originally was farmland. And after the boom of the computers in 1979, a large portion of the country moved to the Northeast. And Northborough was one of those towns that just kept building and building upon what was already there. How white? It was very white. It was almost, well, when I first moved there, I believe there was three other Asians in our town that were students in my school. I believe there were about four families. School was okay. I think I had a lot of comfort in the home, and my parents had a good reputation in the community. So it was overall pretty good. But there were times when kids would call me names, like, you know, Chink or a Gook, and I didn't really understand what they were calling me. But, you know, I would soon, you know, figure it out. And of course, they would always ask, you know, the students if there was racism in our school, and all the students would say no. And but that was Northborough. You know, it was not like New York City. There was no melting pot. Well, you know, I guess that was the term that a few of my relatives used. I guess when I was younger, I had a big old stomach and a little body, and I looked like one of those little statues you would find at a Chinese restaurant. And I think one of my uncles called me Little Buddha, and I think they rubbed my stomach for good luck. Well, I was too young to respond to that, actually. You know, a lot of the things that, you know, had happened to me had been, you know, communicated to me, you know, in stories. And as an adult, you know, I looked back and I thought about, you know, what they said to me. And I, you know, I was like, wow, I couldn't believe, you know, they would say something like that. But I think at the time I didn't really know, you know, what they were calling me. Like, I was 1, 2, or 3 years old. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, for new teachers, you know, they would say my name and I would say here, and they would, you know, keep calling that name out. And they were looking for someone that, you know, matched, you know, the identity of Rayberg. And but finally, you know, I would say, hey, it's me. And they'd say, oh, okay. And I'd have to explain to them the story. And the story is that, and I'm adopted, and I would tell the teacher that I'm from Vietnam, and how my parents, you know, adopted me at the end of the war, and that I'm proud to be a Rayberg now. Most of the time, the teacher pulled me aside at the end of class and saved me the embarrassment of, you know, having to explain myself. It was a pretty small town, so a lot of the students I'd met in nursery school, and then I'd met them again in elementary school, and then in middle school, two other schools joined at a larger school. But pretty much, you know, through sports, it was a pretty, you know, close, you know, population. Yeah, you know, I had a couple, you know, occasions where when students, you know, were jealous of me, I think they took it out on me by pushing me around and, you know, making fun of me. And I think they probably didn't understand, you know, why I looked so different. And the only references they had were, you know, what was on TV or in movies. Sometimes, you know, I would come across people who, you know, the kids who knew a little bit about the Vietnam War, and of course my face was definitely the face of the enemy. So, you know, a lot of it was, you know, ignorant, you know, things being, you know, sent my way. And again, at the time, I really didn't know what to do with it, but I remember it being, you know, tough, you know, a couple of times, you know, having to, you know, go home every day, you know, knowing how different I was and how I couldn't do anything about it. You know, I didn't really know much. I think my parents had tried to explain it to me, but I wasn't really interested, so I think I ignored them for the most part. You know, I think they told me a little about the war. They told me, you know, about how there was a woman, you know, who was my birth mother. And but you know, I think I was trying so hard to be white that I didn't care about being Asian at the time. I wanted to be just like everybody else. I sounded like everybody else. I acted like everybody else. I mean, I didn't carry a mirror in my pocket, so I couldn't see what I looked like all the time. I just knew that these are the people that were my friends, and I trusted a lot of them, and I knew my family cared about me. But, you know, when you watch TV and you see people that look like you, or, you know, sometimes my parents would take me to a Chinese buffet and I'd see the people that looked just like me, and but I didn't understand what they were saying, and they looked at me funny, and they'd always ask me, you know, do you speak Chinese? And I'd look at my parents and they'd say no. So it was definitely, you know, one of those experiences that you really can't explain until you get older. And, you know, I'm glad I've had the opportunity, you know, through music and through writing and through meeting people in the adoption community to let them know that there are a lot of things that, you know, adoptive parents may worry about that they really don't have to worry about, because it takes time. And every stage of my life, I learned something new about myself and my heritage. And but for most of my childhood, I really didn't know how to care. I really didn't know what to expect. I just knew that there was a warm meal waiting for me, and I was very grateful for that. And I had a bed at night to sleep in. I love my parents. They are two hippies that were in grad school down in State College at Penn State, and they got the advertisement in the newspaper that babies were coming over from Vietnam and they needed homes. And they thought there was way too many kids on this planet already, so they chose to adopt, and they seeked out a social worker. And about a month later, you know, there I was. And they've taught me about, you know, their hippie beliefs, and they you know, really stressed throughout my life, you know, health, you know, good foods, creativity, and love, and compassion, and, you know, honesty. And they really they allowed me to have my own spiritual journey, and they've always supported me in my education, and they allowed me to try instruments and sent me to art classes. And I think they really just wanted me to find out and learn how to express myself, you know, the best I could. My belief is that, I'm sorry, the hippie beliefs. Oh, you know, they're definitely anti-war, and they ate, you know, like my dad was a vegetarian, so that was a part of, you know, the hippie, you know, beliefs. And they, you know, they believed in peace.
Wait. Take that from again. That was a part of the hippie beliefs, because.
Oh.
Okay. Just take that again.
What the hippie beliefs were?
No. You were saying that was part of the hippie beliefs,
okay.
And the chair creaked.
Okay, and that was a part of the hippie beliefs. You know, putting together the granola and the making, you know, necklaces made out of flowers, and doing macrame in the basement, and just a lot of creativity and a lot of love. Well, I think that there was a part of me that always knew I was different. I don't think I called it adoption, but there was, you know, always, I think always, you know, subconsciously, I always knew I was different. But I think adopted, hang on a second. That's right. Hang on one second. Okay. I think the first time I knew I was really adopted, you know, was when TV commercials came on. And I think it was in the late 80s, and there were some organizations that had ads on TV about foster, you know, children and adoption, and I made the connection. And but again, at the time, I just didn't want to deal with it, so I blocked it out. And you know, I was so involved with, you know, school plays and playing instruments and painting and drawing that I really found a way to avoid it, really. But I think I always knew. They tried to talk to me about it, but again, you know, I'd worked so hard to be like everybody else. I didn't want to be different. They would, you know, share stories about, you know, how hard it was for a birth mother to give up a child. I think they talked about, you know, Vietnam a little bit more, and how much they loved me, and that, you know, I have a wonderful life here and with opportunities. And I think they really tried their best to comfort me, and I think I definitely, you know, appreciated that a lot. And I know that my love for them today, you know, is partially because of their, you know, the opportunity that they took, whether I was listening or not, they at least, you know, let me know that there was love, and they let me know the truth about. I had one Asian friend growing up. Yeah, he lived down the street about a mile away, and we did lots of fun boys things, like, you know, playing basketball and throwing the football around and watching movies. But he was extra special because I had a chance to, you know, try the rice and the egg rolls and pork buns and all that really great stuff. And he was, you know, my connection to you know, Asian American, you know, culture. And they definitely, you know, opened the door for me and welcomed me with open arms, and I will forever be grateful for that. And my friend, you know, Jeff passed away back in 1998, and it was really sad for him to go, but he definitely inspires me every day of my life. You know, I try to live my life to the fullest, and two of my songs are dedicated to him. The songs are Beautiful Life, and another song that I'm actually looking to record this spring, and it's called San Francisco, Jeffrey's song. And it just feels good, you know, to thank him, because I didn't know how to thank him when I was younger. And now that I'm all grown up and I, you know, started to realize the impact he had on my life, I hope that, you know, somewhere you can hear me singing those songs when I play out at night. It's great to be on stage and sing to him. A little. That's why I think that it worked so well between us, because there were definitely more people that seemed more Asian than him. So I definitely realized that later on in life, that he was the perfect match for me, because he was, you know, just, you know, as much, you know, within the community, you know, of our school friends as he was with his Chinese friends from another state. I'm an American with Vietnamese blood. You know, my heritage is Vietnamese, but I'm American. And when I see people on the street, I expect them to speak English to me. I give them no other reason. And I am insulted when people ask me, hey, do you speak English? You know, I know that, you know, through, you know, the writings of Frank Wu, his book Yellow, you know, he seems to believe that, you know, Asian Americans are still viewed as foreigners in this country. And that's really sad, because if I'm on vacation, man, I'm working way too hard to be on vacation. And there's a lot of times when I go to Chinatown in New York, and, you know, tourists stop me and they say, excuse me, do you speak English? And I say, yes, I do. Can I help you? And they say, where is this restaurant? And I say, oh, it's down the street, and blah, blah, blah. And I every time I want to give them a nasty look, but I don't, because that's not helping out. And I know that there's someone else out there that will give them a nasty look, but it's not going to be me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, my very first time was in 1995 at a reunion in York, Pennsylvania, and it was just a special reunion for my orphanage. And I was in college, you know, I was going through my hippie stage with the long hair and the Grateful Dead t-shirts, and I guess I really liked the opportunity to go down, but I wasn't really sure what to expect. And I know I was very surprised when I met all the people that were there, because they were all different from me. And I was surprised because I thought they would be the same as me, but they were not. Well, the adoptees at the reunion had come from the same, you know, we had similar, you know, upbringings. We all lived in white towns. We were all pretty much the same age, and we had all thought about, you know what it might have been like to know our past, you know, and we all had questions and we all were looking for some answers. But I think at the time, a majority of us weren't really ready to hear the answers, and we didn't have all the questions that we wanted to ask, you know. I think inside of me, I wasn't sure if I could emotionally handle somebody telling me the truth about how, you know, life was in an orphanage and just how bad it really was, and to hear about the lives that were lost and all the babies that didn't make it out, and to have to hear, you know, about the struggles that many nurses, you know, went through just to get us out. And it was very overwhelming to finally hear it, you know, 5 years later. And the first experience in 95 was kind of a practice run. You know, we had a nice, great, you know, group picture. We got to meet Betty Tisdale, and she was the woman that ran the orphanage back in 75. And we all went home with a sneak peek of, with a little glimpse of our past. But the biggest reunion of them all was in 2000. It was down in Baltimore. It was a national reunion, and I met over 215, you know, adoptees that came from all around the country. And it was awesome. It was really great. We were all a lot older, and we were ready to make friends, and we were ready to share stories. And I still have many friends from the reunion in my life right now. And not because they're adopted from Vietnam, it's just because they're great people. And we all had moments where we shared stories, and we kind of, you know, I guess we found comfort in our similarities and our views of the world. And it was definitely an amazing experience to reach out and give somebody a hug, and to know that that hug was filled with the same, you know, love that we had, because we were American, we were Asian, we had moments of confusion, and but we're still alive. We do, definitely. Well, you know, as an adoptee, we don't feel fully a part of the Asian American community. We don't feel a part of the white community. And I think that we've found ourselves in almost a third space. And it's amazing to realize that, because it helps understand, you know, why there was some confusion, and, you know, how so many of us tried so hard to change, to be different, when we could have just been ourselves, and we could have taken pride and celebrated who we were as adoptees. And I think the future, you know, with the leadership of our adult adopted community today, I'm very proud to be one of the leaders when I travel and I speak at, you know, adoption conferences, and I play my music. And I recently, you know, launched an e-magazine with a Korean adoptee, you know, named Lisa Hansen, and she and I put together an e-magazine called In Third Space, and it gives a, you know, a space for other adoptees from all different backgrounds, a place to talk and meet and, you know, get things out, because we both found that expressing ourselves was the best medicine. Definitely, I will. Oh, Richard Silver, great, great, great guy. I met Richard Silver on the trip to Vietnam this summer. World Airways invited a select group, and was so honored to be invited by Shirley Peck Barnes. Unfortunately, she passed away last Saturday. It's very sad. I was in her book, The War Cradle. I was so proud to submit a small writing. It wasn't really a poem, wasn't really an essay, but it was something that I was contributing. It was my first opportunity to speak. It almost, you know, was the inspiration to, you know, be a singer-songwriter at the time. Yeah, Richard and I share similar views on adoption. I think we both, you know, are so glad to be alive, and so, you know, glad to, you know, to be here. And we're always available to talk to any adoptees, adult adoptees or younger adoptees, who want to talk. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. I got to play at the Reunification Palace, and it's a very few people have played that palace. And I'm, you know, I got up on stage and plugged in my guitar. I looked out at the country officials, and without being dramatic, I got to tell you, I was thinking about my birth parents and thinking, you know, this was the closest I was going to be to communicating with them. And there was a lot of press there that day, and I announced who the song was, you know, for, and I sang it the best I could, and that was, you know, that opportunity to sing out and to be one of the children that didn't have a name. That was my name. My name was my song. And, you know, if my picture was in the paper and someone thought I looked like somebody, I mean, a lot of people looked alike there, so it's going to be pretty hard. But, you know, if someone, you know, saw my face and wanted to claim me as their son, hey, you know, that's wonderful. But I wrote that song, you know, for myself, and I wrote it for them, and it was just amazing to be in Vietnam with those other 20 adoptees, you know, from all around the country, and we get a chance to meet with the officials of the country, and they told us how sorry they were that, you know, things happened the way they did, and they welcomed us home, and that was something that I think that I'd waited for a long time. But I didn't really know that I was waiting for it until it actually happened. And I feel like it's my home. And, you know, I tried to be as non-political as possible. But, you know, I personally feel that they should, you know, think about their human rights a little bit more. And for the few Vietnamese people that were upset that I'd left, I told them that wasn't my choice. And, you know, for the Vietnamese people that were upset that white people were adopting babies, well, I would look to them and I would say, hey, you could have adopted us too. And so I think it's, you know, there's two sides of every story. But I'm a peaceful person. And like I said, I'm glad to be alive. And I think that I communicated that through my music and through my handshakes and the hugs that I shared with the Vietnamese people. Yeah, there was a media company that worked with World Airways, and they documented. I'm looking forward to seeing the documentary film. They just mailed it to me yesterday. And it's going to be great to see myself perform. I never got a chance to see it. So I'm really excited about that. And I performed on the airplane, and my friends emailed me from home. They're like, oh, you were on Yahoo, you know. And when I search my name, you know, my website comes up, but I also have you know, links to 25 other newspapers from around the country with a quote, and it was great. You know, I think it's just great to be a part of history. My brother is adopted from Korea, and he doesn't have this amazing story, and I'm so grateful to have it. and I hope that he does go back to Korea someday, but he hasn't been inspired yet. He and my sister is also adopted. She's adopted from Philadelphia, I believe, and she's half black. And the one thing that they have that I don't is I think they have birth names, and I think that someday they each have an opportunity to seek out that birth family if they want to, and I'm always going to be there for them if they want to talk to me, and I think, you know, if they ever do decide to reconnect, I'll definitely, you know, enjoy it with them, because, you know, it's been a long time, you know, for me, you know, thinking about the fact that I'll never be able to, you know, meet my birth parents, but I've made a lot of peace with that, and I think it's also helped me move forward. No, not at all. We are, all three of us are very different. And I think that our parents, you know, individually spoke with us. You know, I'm 5 years older than my brother. That was definitely a lot of, you know, social distance in age through school and through friends. And my sister was only 1 year older than me, but she ran with a different crowd as well. Well, the reunification palace is where the North took over the South. It was actually, well, the palace itself was where the South Vietnamese government controlled everything. And on the stage where I performed was where, after the tank crashed through the gate, the leader from the North ran inside the building, looked at the guy from the South and said, you know, we're here to take over. And I believe the man from the South said, I will give up my power. And the man from the North said, well, you have no power to give up. Just leave. And then that was it. And the North took over. And yeah, I did. I definitely did. You know, the history has always been a favorite thing of mine. I watched the history, you know, God bless cable TV. I watched the History Channel, Discovery Channel, the Learning Channel. Right, exactly. And, yeah. Yeah, if you contact World Airways, Kimberly Williams, I will send you the information that I have. Yes. Okay. Okay. Definitely. Okay. Yes. Operation Baby Lift. When did I learn about that? I think my parents told me stories about it a lot, but I didn't care. But I think it really, you know, hit home after the 95 reunion, and my thoughts started to grow, and I realized, you know, what had happened, and how Gerald Ford, you know, signed that document, and, you know, 3,000 children that, you know, needed homes, you know, got homes. And on the side, there was a lot of red tape, and there was a lot of accusations coming from the Vietnamese government. They called it the biggest kidnapping in the history of the world. And there were a lot of birth mothers who had been lied to, and they were told that their babies were going to be taken care of, and they were going to come back and get their babies. And when they came back, their babies were gone. And there was a lot of stories like that. And yeah, those stories are hard for me to think about, you know? But again, life goes on. I'm sorry. Yeah, I did. The orphanage was a two-story building. In the middle of Saigon, and now today it's an army barracks. It's where, or it's like a government housing army barracks. Back in 2002, when I went to Vietnam for the first time, I got off the tour bus and walked down the alleyway, and I looked at the building, and I took a deep breath, and touched the ground, and symbolically, I told myself, you know, this was as far as I was going to get, and I, you know, waited a long time for that, and you know, I took a deep breath and took some pictures, and some people came out to see what was going on, and the person, our interpreter was there, and he tried to explain to everybody, you know, what I was doing there, and they, you know, smiled and they waved, and I went back to the bus, and we drove away, and it was really great to hold that, you know, memory with me, and I have some pictures in my room of the. You know, I got the emotions were so erratic. I mean, there were moments where, you know, I was so relieved that it was, you know, it was over. You know, finally there it was. And then there was other emotions I had of, you know, God, I wish that, you know, the story could get better and better. And, you know, I could all of a sudden, you know, someone would come out of nowhere and tell me that they know who I was, you know, and there were fantasies about, you know, getting paperwork, but it wasn't to be, and I think I took all those crazy emotions and I took them back on the bus and I put them in my notebook and I started writing. You know, that's what they belonged to me. They belonged to, you know my comprehension of the moment, and I have it, you know, written in songs and in, you know, in writings. And you know, at night at the hotel room, you know, I took some time and I pretended to speak to my birth parents, and I was, you know, it was in the dark, and I just spoke out loud and I said, you know, I'm here, and I hope you're well, and you know, wherever you are, whether you're dead or alive, but I made it, and Waking Up American definitely emerged from that. Some of the lyrics, let's see. Well, one of the lyrics, was when I looked out the window of the hotel, I could see all those bikes going by. And the beginning of the song is, I see you, you know, on my TV, you know, rushing home from work on crowded streets. And, when I was younger, I do remember, you know, watching TV and seeing clips from Asia, and they would show lots of people on mopeds driving, you know, around the city. And I said to myself, oh, you know, someone in that picture, you know, may be related to me because they look just like me. And those are the memories that I've kept for a long time. And they were small memories that really didn't have, you know, long drawn out detail, but they were simple things that I'll never forget. Like when I go to bed at night, you know, I always think about Vietnam. And when I wake up in the morning, you know, ever since the reunion, I'm just so lucky to be alive, and I make it a point, you know, and I smile, and it's just, you know, just great. It's just great to be here. And being in Vietnam definitely was a closure. It was an opening. I'm just grateful that I got a chance to be there. And I never will meet my birth parents now. Because they don't know who dropped me off, and there's no birth certificate, and that's it. So, well, you know, there is a slight chance that the pictures that were taken during our visit, maybe somebody would see that photograph. But one theory would be that, you know, my birth parents could already be dead, or my birth parents could be living in a distant village and not have any access to the city at all. So, but those are all stories I take to bed with me, and they're all wonderful stories. And that's, you know, that's my life, and I'm living my life the best I can. You know, I work hard during the day. I love my job, love my family, love my friends, love playing music. Can't ask for anything more. Yes, Betty Tisdale ran my orphanage back in Vietnam, and she and Madam Nye were responsible for feeding all the babies. And when we came over, they were responsible for saving the lives of 219 children. And her story is in the first edition of Chicken Soup for the Soul. Yeah, she was the Angel of Saigon. And she's still in her mid-70s. I saw her last night for a pre-Thanksgiving dinner. Yep, her daughter and I are friends, and her daughter lives in New York City. And as an adult, I seeked out a relationship with her. It's always great to see her and give her a hug. And she's still doing the same thing. She's traveling from country to country, raising money for, orphanages. And she has her own organization. And it's just amazing. And I told her, I said, I'm following your footsteps. I'm trying my hardest to make a living being myself. And, with hard work and dedication, I might be on my way. I'm looking to maybe write a book for the adoptive parents to let them know, how my experience was growing up in America. My music is definitely on the way. I have more songs coming. I'm looking to record another album. And I was just invited to Arizona for January. And I'm looking forward to performing out there for those families. And who knows? I started writing music just a little while after that reunion in 1995 in Pennsylvania. And it was small little things that I kept to myself. It wasn't until 2001 when I started putting my first album together that I really dug in and dedicated myself. After work, I would travel an hour to a small studio in Connecticut, and where I was living at the time. And I laid out each track one by one. And, it was going to be a gift for my parents. And I had some friends that thought that maybe having a website would be cool. So I went out, got myself a website. I put up some pictures and allowed people to listen to them. And then one day someone said, can I buy it? And I spent some more money and created a cover to a CD. And I was a musician. And, every day, I was connected to more people through my website, more adoptees, more adoptive parents. And I started being invited to all these great events, and I got to perform my songs, and people started crying, and I didn't understand why. But then, I just started reading my stuff and not singing it, and I realized that if I were hearing it for the first time, I might be very, very touched as well. So that's one satisfaction out of the, it can be completely exhausting at the same time, getting up on stage and singing about my life for 25 minutes, having to relive the same stories and relive the same questions every night. It can be hard, but I know that if I can reach out and I can help another adoptee begin their thoughts and begin their search, I'm proud if I can help an adoptive parent, see, just, how much work it takes to be an adoptive parent. I know I've done my job. I definitely, it's amazing. When an adoptee comes up to me and tells me, how courageous it was for me to share my story, or just tell me that, I have a nice voice. That's always a plus. And I think that through, the mixture of entertainment and history, the adoptees, they definitely they touched me in a way, because that's why I created this music. Yes. At the 2000 reunion, there was many people who grew up in different parts of the country that were faced with, you know, much more teasing, you know, much more harassment, and even some physical abuse. And I gave them, you know, big hugs, but I know that that hug is not going to erase those scars. And I hope that, you know, in the future that, you know, they can, you know, learn to, you know, understand it wasn't their fault, and that they can surround themselves with, you know, positive people, and as adults they can, you know, share their experiences, hopefully, with, you know, other I think that, you know, in the Midwest it was a lot harder for adoptees to go to school, and it was definitely, you know, less diverse than in the Northeast. I just know there were, you know, a lot of stories of, you know, kids being, you know, beat up after school, and always, you know, I mean, some of them were challenged, you know, because everyone thought that, you know, Asian people took karate, and you know, a lot of them didn't take karate. And I can speak, you know, from my own experiences, when you are, you know, looked upon as having these stereotypes that you don't really have, it can be annoying and frustrating when teachers, you know, would ask you about math questions, or people in just in general would ask you about math questions, or when you go to a restaurant, someone would say, "Oh, does this dish taste good?" Well, I'm supposed to know, or how do you pronounce this, you know, or have you seen that Asian movie? No, Bobby Lee. I'll have to check that out. Oh, that's great. I wish I'll look for that. Yeah. Yes. Well, yes. Cries of a Woman is a favorite song of mine. I wrote that song. It was based on a child's report from a high school in Connecticut, and it was a story about an American woman who was a soldier. And she was narrating the story, and how she met a woman named Jane in the Philippines, who was adopting a baby from Vietnam. But before she got to the Philippines, she had gone to Vietnam and to pick up her baby. But her baby was on the C-5 crash airplane. And the song sings about that woman's experience. But it ends happy, and she does adopt a child, and she takes the child home. Just a song? Well, Wash Over Me is the song I wrote about going back to Vietnam for the first time and trying to make peace with, you know, what I knew about my past and how I wanted to go forward and what I saw in Vietnam. And just accepting. It was my song of acceptance of who I am. And Waking Up American was the song for my birth parents. You know, be proud of who you are. Read books. Play music. Learn how to play instruments. It's a lot of fun. And we can teach others. I think a lot of people are surprised. Especially through, you know, my work email. I work for an Asian company, and when I send emails out and it says Jared Rayberg, sometimes I get comments, you know, And sometimes I get comments about, you know, my name. Oh, you know, how many non-whites are there besides you? And I say, oh, well, I'm adopted. And I give them my website, and then they return back and they go, oh, okay, I see. Yeah, you know, that's definitely been an annoyance in my life a few times. And having to explain myself all the time, you know, some people would say, oh, your mom married, you know, a white guy. And I say, no, you know, or, you know, I just, you know, adoption is not the first thing off people's tongues, really. And they say, oh, that's an interesting name. And I say, oh, thanks. And, but usually people think I'm Jewish, which I'm not. Actually, Rehberg's German. It'd be Rechberg, I guess, in Germany. Yeah. You know, I would encourage, you know, any Asian adoptee to learn about, you know, their heritage. Go to Barnes and Nobles, get out a book. You know, watch you know, TV, if there are specials on about Asia. And take pride in being Asian. And the battle of stereotypes is in our hands. And I hope that they don't feel that they're expected to be anything but themselves. And I hope the adoptive parents allow each child to be themselves. And I think that that's a part of the journey of life. And in some way, I feel I've been challenged. And it took me a long time to accept the challenge, but I have fully accepted this challenge as an adoptee. I definitely am. I have a few songs that I'm in the middle of writing right now, and I look forward to... one of my songs, it's called Scrapbook, and this song is for the younger generation. And the song basically sings about how... you know, I can't change what's already been done, but this is my life, and I'm going to live it my way. Yeah, I want them to know that, you know, you can't change what's already been done, but you can take control of your life, and you can make the most of it. And these, you know, these moments are just pages out of a large scrapbook, and every day you learn something new. And it's just been, it can be an amazing experience or it can be a frustrating experience. I always recommend the amazing experience. Well, thank you so much. Okay, hang on 1 second.
There's one question I think you might want to do over because
okay.
The phone,
okay.
You had the phone blocking.
Which
the
one?
The question about, you know, are you resolved that you're never going to meet your birth parents?
Okay. Okay. I'm going to answer another question again. You still there? Okay. Okay. All right. So basically, it's the one about am I resolved about not ever meeting my brother? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Do you remember what you said?
Yeah. Kind of. All right.
That they may have been. They may have left the city and.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, overall, I'm pretty resolved about never meeting my birth parents. I've known for a long time that there was no birth certificate. I've known for a long time that when we boarded the plane, Betty and Madame Nye made up names for us and gave us birthdays, and we were on our way to a better life. But I know, you know, out there, you know, in some village, you know, maybe there's a woman. She probably has children, and those children have probably grown up, and they're probably on their way. And, you know, maybe for a moment she thinks about the child that she gave up, and that's one memory that I have. You know, and maybe my birth parents have passed away a long time ago, and I keep that memory with me too. And I know that, you know, they're looking down on me. and I hope that they're proud of me, and I hope that they know that I made the most of this opportunity, and they gave me life, and they've allowed me to reach out and be a part of other people's lives. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'll end on a happy note, okay? All right. Actually, there is one thing that I might want to mention. Okay. My journey to get to New York City has been a highlight of my life. I worked my way, up through the ranks of graphic designers in Connecticut, going from, a production department to a publishing, group. And, one night I was playing at the open mic that I play in New York City, in Chinatown, called Teabag Open Mic. And this was about 2 years ago. And a gentleman came up to me and introduced himself as the CEO of a startup company called Imagination TV. And he said that he hoped to launch this cable network that would showcase movies and documentaries and anime and music. And they're going to start in a small building on 34th and 7th. And I immediately said, oh, can I have a job? And he asked me what my qualifications were, and I told him that I do everything, including taking out the trash. And that opportunity that he gave me to live in New York City, I moved everything from Connecticut down to New York, and I started working. And I've had an opportunity to work with Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Filipino, Vietnamese, so many great people here that have, welcomed me with open arms, and I'm proud to be working here, and they consider me an Asian American.